Welcome to the global edition of the Ned Group Investments Quarterly Highlights, where we profile some of the interesting takeouts from our recent fund manager workshop with our global best of breed managers. To hear the full fund manager presentations or for more information about our funds, visit the Ned Group Investments website or access more of our content via LinkedIn, YouTube, and podcast channels. As we dive into 2025, we reflect on a year marked by significant market events and policy shifts. With Trump entering his second term amidst persistent US inflation and the Chinese market concluding 2024 positively despite volatility, what can we expect for the year ahead? We explore the impact of Trump's policies on bond markets, the resilience of the real estate sector, and the economic situation in China. Our managers share their perspectives on tariffs, trade policies, and the importance of a conservative approach to equity investments in the current high valuations environment. David Roberts, co-portfolio manager of the Ned Group Investments Global Strategic Bond Fund, discusses the impact of Trump's policies on bond markets, highlighting concerns about tariffs, trade barriers, deglobalization, and anti-immigrant policies, which have led to worries about sticky inflation and potentially lower growth.
The impact of Mr. Trump coming in has been to worry bond markets. The suggestion about tariffs, about trade barriers, about deglobalization, about anti-immigrant policies, all creating a concern that we would see sticky inflation and perhaps less growth than people were hoping for, although obviously the Republican Party would argue that it is a growth positive agenda. But the impact of that has been to see bond yields move higher. Now, our view is that there is a little bit too much of that bad news, that pro-inflation news priced into markets. And indeed, interest rate markets are now pricing for less in terms of interest rate cuts than most central banks are suggesting. If you roll all that together, we would say that the core expectation from our side is that, again, most of the returns will be driven by income, but we could see a small degree of positive capital gain. The core from our perspective in terms of total return really would be in that 5 to 8% range. The possibility that we do better than that, maybe low double digits, we would ascribe a probability of maybe about 0.2, so about 20% to that. But the flip side is if we do see some very aggressive policies from the US and having spreads out to the rest of the world, there could be a little bit of downside risk, but in aggregate, we would expect positive mid-single digits, and in terms of total return, maybe just slightly better than we have seen this year as the market settles down and starts to realise we're not going into a significant reflationary phase in 2025.
Rob Promisel, co-portfolio manager of the Ned Group Investments Global Property Fund, discusses why he is optimistic about the real estate sector despite the challenges posed by a higher interest rate environment.
I'm incredibly encouraged by real estate today. I know that it's a bit of an unloved sector in a world where we're navigating through higher interest rates. But if you step back and put that macro aside and you just look at the durability of demand, the economies are doing pretty well and demand for real estate is derived by economic activity. And so we're constructive about the demand profile for commercial real estate going forward. And then you match with what I said earlier, there being fairly limited construction activity because there just isn't the construction finance available. Banks have pulled back due to higher risk-based capital requirements. The securitization of debt off their balance sheets is still not back fully functioning. So we just don't find that there's nearly as much speculative construction starts as there's been historically. And that is a very good setup going into 26 and 27 for there being less competitive supply. And so the outlook then when you have stable to growing demand in an environment where there's less competitive supply is that landlords should have pricing power. We should be able to drive earnings growth going forward. So pretty constructive about the operational setup. And then the capital structure for these companies has been significantly de-risked over the past many years. Leverage is controlled. It's low. Maturities are laddered. And so the financial interest risk, yes, there will be an increase in interest expense as debt matures, but we just don't think that it's going to be all at once. And so the setup is one where the capital structure also has been de-risked. So we're pretty constructive about the outlook for real estate and think that where we should expect to see earnings growth in the mid to high single digits for many of these companies prospectively over the next several years.
Brian Coffey, Portfolio Manager of the Ned Group Investments Global Emerging Markets Fund, provides his insights on the impact of tariffs and trade policies under Trump and Biden, particularly focusing on China and Mexico.
I mean, there's a couple of viewpoints on tariffs and the impact of Trump on trade. If you look at China in particular, Trump was hostile to China in his last term in office, and Biden was also pretty tough on China. And if you look at China's dependence on the US as an export market, it's really not that significant. So it's actually been coming down as China has exported around Asia and the southern EM markets in particular. So I don't think it's such a big problem for China, although the mood music is certainly not going to be positive. China's got a very competitive currency, which will allow it to continue to be an export country. Mexico, exports as a percentage of GDP in Mexico are a completely different story than the case in China. So whereas in China, we're looking at sub 3% of GDP exported to the US, in the case of Mexico, that's closer to 25%. That has been falling recently, but you know, it's closer to 25%. That's not net exports. So, you know, China takes a lot of intermediate goods from the US and then re-exports them back to the US. Sorry, Mexico. So Mexico is in a more difficult position, it would seem. The thing is that one of the issues for Trump seems to be the potential for Mexico as a backdoor export venue to the US by China. That hasn't been the case so far. So most of the exports from Mexico to the US, mainly American companies doing some production in Mexico and then re-importing those goods into. So we don't see much a threat to that. However, it's definitely going to be part of his negotiating tactics. In terms of Chinese investment for their, if you like, Trojan horse entry into the US economy, they really are a small part and have been a relatively small part, but not zero. So we're not dismissing it. They've been a small part of FDI into Mexico. It has increased in recent years, but it still remains much smaller than US or European or Korean or Taiwanese investment in Mexico. So we don't really see that as a huge issue.
Daniel McDonough, Portfolio Manager of the Ned Group Investments Global Cautious Fund, discusses the economic situation in China, highlighting that Chinese yields have fallen below Japanese yields, a stark contrast with China's historical role as a significant contributor to global growth.
What we've seen is that Chinese yields have actually fallen below, 30-year yields have actually fallen below the level of Japanese yields. And for so long, that would have been almost incomprehensible because we're used to China being the engine of growth for the global economy, you know, 6% regularly, and if not 6, then near enough 5. And simultaneously, we've grown used to Japan being the victim of deflation and just not being able to kickstart its economy. So to have an indicator that's suggesting that, you know, Japanese prospects are brighter than Chinese ones from an economic standpoint, that really is something. Of course, the key issue here is that China seems to be at risk of deflation. You know, CPI inflation is close to zero in China. PPI has been negative, so deflationary for a while. And that's obviously been driven to a large extent by the deflating of a property bubble that they've had. And, you know, that's something that ironically, I think was responsible for Japan's or partly responsible for a lot of Japan's problems over the last sort of 30 years. And so now we find ourselves in this situation where we're talking about the Japanification of China, ironically enough. And, you know, that deflationary issue is clearly the big one. You know, weak domestic demand low income growth, elevated leverage ratios, and particularly with real estate in mind, you know, declining asset prices. And that's not good for Chinese consumer confidence. And that's really pivotal to changing the story here. What we have seen is that the Chinese authorities have attempted to signal that they're willing to intervene. So there were some measures there in Q3, Q4 of 2024, which is good in terms of showing their ability and intention to help. But I don't think anybody is under the illusion that those measures are enough by themselves to combat the deeply deflationary pressures that are seem to be really taking hold in that Chinese economy. So a real turnaround, a real role reversal there.
Daniel also cautions that with bond markets indicating rates are likely to stay higher for longer, a safety-first, conservative approach to equity investments is important.
This is the type of environment that where investors will be best served by avoiding particular characteristics in the equity market. And we think those characteristics are the quickest way to put capital at risk. So we don't want to be investing in companies that are overvalued. You know, high multiples, they demand to be constantly justified. So even meeting expectations is often not enough for those companies to sustain those elevated multiples. So that's a risky game we don't want to play. And we also think that the other key risk is investing in companies that are over-leveraged. You know, with bond markets telling us rates are likely to stay higher for longer, you really want balance sheet integrity. And that's going to be key to avoiding any of the worst of an equity market correction should it occur. So it is a safety-first conservative approach, certainly on the equity side.
Ian Clark, portfolio manager of the Ned Group Investments Global Equity Fund, addresses the recent underperformance of the fund and identifies the primary contributing factors. He emphasizes the significance of adhering to the fund's established process and philosophy, particularly in the context of the prevailing market environment.
As you know, our process emphasizes value discipline and capital preservation. And while this means we'll often be able to deploy capital quickly into bargains during market corrections, it can also mean we lag in rapidly rising markets, as we have been doing. I think that what's been particularly painful over the last 3 to 5 years is the narrowness and concentration in the market, with a large percentage of returns coming from the Magnificent Seven stocks that you'll have heard of. To be overweight these group of stocks, you either had to buy indiscriminately or have very large positions in your favored names, but at ever high valuations as they've appreciated. This is inconsistent with our approach, one which emphasizes value discipline and capital preservation. It's important to say that while this is unfortunate, we do not think it means our process is flawed, just that it's suffered because of the prevailing circumstances over the last couple of years. When we look at attribution, you can see these dynamics playing out in the 12-month number. You can see our individual tech names contributing positively, cropping up in a number of different sectors, but the large negative contribution from the IT sector as a whole, and our more defensive positions in healthcare and staples detracting. In short, we don't own Apple, Tesla, Nvidia, or Meta, and this has hurt. Going forward, we think it's unlikely that these companies are the headwind to relative performance that they have been, as they can't re-rate to the same degree again, and the multiples that they're on now requires pristine performance. It's also worth noting that capital intensity is rising, which isn't a good thing either.
Mark Landecker, co-portfolio manager of the Ned Group Investments Global Flexible Fund, discusses their view on credit given the current high-yield environment.
Well, despite rates on high yield having moved higher alongside rising rates, the actual spread on high yield compared to treasuries or investment grade credit is bouncing along historical lows. When we combine this with the relatively weak credit protection attached to recent high yield issuance in the form of non-existent or paper thin covenants, our bar to get involved in high yield in general would require a rate of return north of what's currently available.
Mark also discusses the success story of Alphabet, the top holding in the Global Flexible Fund.
We originally purchased Alphabet back in 2010. And at that time, we never would have thought that the business would grow to the size it has today. That growth has been driven not just by search, but by other segments of the business that have been phenomenal successes. That includes YouTube, the cloud business, Waymo, and several others. If you think about Alphabet as a whole, the company actually has more properties with 500 million users than any other company globally. This has allowed the business to generate tremendous amounts of data. It's built out infrastructure that is unrivaled on a global basis and has employees who we consider to be leading as it relates to virtually all aspects of artificial intelligence, the cloud, and search. Within that, Google continues to respond to roughly 8.5 billion searches per day in their core business, of which roughly 13% are new. That would equate to over 3 trillion searches per year, if my math's correct. Now, there have been concerns about competition encroaching on Google's search business, which continues to drive the majority of the company's earnings. However, since the introduction of ChatGPT, Google has continued to maintain roughly 90% plus market share in almost all of its core markets. During that period, we've continued to also see YouTube grow. We have Waymo that is now providing roughly 20% of the rides in early launch markets, such as San Francisco. And earnings have continued to expand along with that of the core business and ancillary products. When we look forward in the age of AI, we see Google as being particularly well positioned for the reasons we mentioned earlier. The company has access to amongst the greatest trove of data in the world across its various properties, has incredible infrastructure, and very talented people. We think those are ingredients that set the company up very well for how the AI competitive aspect will evolve over the coming years. And we look forward to monitoring new product introductions as they are released over the next 12 to 24 months.
Thank you for listening to the Nade Group Investments quarterly briefing. You can access more information about all the fund manager workshops at the Nade Group Investments website, YouTube, or through our podcast channels on all major platforms. Please join us for our next edition at the end of April 2025.